This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today, we talk about something simple. Theoretical physics. Well, at least it's not rocket science. No, actually, it's worse. In fact, if my high school physics teacher knew that I'd be in on this conversation, he might have encouraged me to call in sick today. That said, our guest today, a theoretical physicist, has the remarkable ability to make this complex topic understandable. And that's a good thing, because he and his colleagues are working on something that promises to open a door to a new world for humanity. After devoting a book to the ultimate theory of time, Dr. Sean Carroll has turned his attention to something that has been in the news quite a lot lately, the hunt for the God particle. They built a super collider to try and settle its existence once and for all, and they were successful. Some say the proof that this particle exists is the greatest breakthrough in our understanding of the universe since the splitting of the atom. But understanding why scientists believe this particle existed, how they proved its existence, and what all this means for us and for future generations isn't easy. So, our guest today wrote a book, The Particle at the End of the Universe, How the Hunt for the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of a New World. This Harvard PhD, now with the California Institute of Technology, has explained it as simply as anyone can and joins us for the hour to take yet another stab at it. Welcome to the program and welcome to Charlotte.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
The doctor is here, by the way, speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at UNC Charlotte. Information about that and about the Science and Technology Expo coming up later on this month is at our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. At the risk of allowing our heads to explode, let us begin with some definitions. In 1964, Dr. Peter Higgs came up with some theories about an energy field that blanketed the universe, which came to be known as the Higgs energy field. You know all this, but I'm just explaining this out for the audience.
Good, yes. I'm well aware.
Of which the Higgs boson particle is the smallest bit, if I understand this correctly, in that field. Before we talk about the particle, let's talk about the field. How do we know? How did we know? Why did he think that it existed?
Well, this is a great point, and it's a great starting place, because the fact that empty space is full of fields is the single concept you really need to be able to swallow in order to understand why the Higgs boson is such a big deal. We talk about the electric field, the gravitational field, and so forth, but everything is a field. And the thing about the Higgs field is that even in empty space, it's not zero. So you can imagine, you know, if you were out there in interstellar space and you had a little box and you shielded everything in the universe so that you had nothing but empty space inside, you would say, well, the electromagnetic field is zero, the gravitational field is zero, etc. But the Higgs field is there. It's out there affecting other particles that move through space. So one analogy I like to give is if a lantern is lit at night and you can see it and someone's walking away from you, it gets dimmer and dimmer as it walks away from you, but gradually. And that's how forces in the universe work, right? The force of gravity that the Earth causes on you, it decreases a little bit as you get further and further away in the solar system and so forth. But there's something called the weak nuclear force that scientists love to talk about, physicists love to talk about. There's two forces of nature that don't extend over long ranges, the nuclear forces, the strong nuclear force and the weak nuclear force. And for the weak nuclear force, the reason why it's confined inside, the reason why it only stretches over a short range rather than extending over the distance between the planets, is because it's like there's a fog that absorbs the light from that lantern, right? The lantern goes away from you, but it's a foggy night, and suddenly it goes away from you just a little bit and you can't see it at all, mm-hmm. because the light rays from that lantern are being absorbed by the fog, by the water vapor around it. Likewise, for the weak nuclear force, an electron or a neutrino, all these little elementary particles, they cause this force. But the lines of force coming out of the particle are absorbed by this field that surrounds them at all times, this Higgs field. So the initial motivation back in 1964 for why should you guess that there is a field filling space that you can't see was that we had this thing called the weak nuclear force, and it had this property that it was short range. It didn't extend over long distances, and nobody knew why. So Peter Higgs and his friends, he was not the only one. There was six or seven people who suggested this idea. But they said, well, we know how we can do it. The math all works out if all you do is imagine that empty space is filled with this invisible energy field. – And, you know, frankly, most physicists reacted in 1964 just like most people would today. They said that's nutso. You know, there's no reason for believing that. Why should you propose that empty space itself is filled with this stuff that absorbs forces and so forth and so forth? 48 years later and $9 billion to build the Large Hadron Collider, we found that they were right.
Wow. In the 60s, when this theory first came up, physicists were trying to understand, as you say, the nuclear forces that held together the nucleus of the atom. And I read this yesterday. I knew nothing about this until yesterday. But when I read this, what shocked me was by that time, we had already built the atom bomb. We had already built nuclear reactors that ran electric plants and submarines and things like that. How could we not have a really solid understanding of nuclear physics by that time?
Well, how is it that you can work your TV set without having a really solid understanding of electronics?
I'm not going to blow up the world when I turn it on. That's why.
Well, it's the difference between sort of being able to know what will happen in simple circumstances and really understanding the guts of something. It's the difference between being able to drive a car and to fix the engine when it breaks down. So in the 40s, 50s, even the 1930s, we worked out the first ideas of what were called nuclear physics. Before then, you know, before Marie Curie and so forth mm-hmm. came along, we thought that the nucleus of an atom was sacrosanct. You know, it didn't change. We had the periodic table of the elements on our wall, and helium would always be helium, and iron would always be iron, and so forth. And then the Curies and other people discovered in one buckets full of Nobel Prizes for showing that nuclei can change. The nucleus of one atom, a heavy one like radium or uranium, can split into smaller ones. And so you might say, well, why? What governs that happening? What are the processes that tell you? What is the physics underlying when a nucleus splits and when it doesn't? And frankly, you know, we were just guessing. We had some ideas that sort of worked at a very crude level back in the 30s and 40s. But there's a lot of experiments that were being done. We said, when you do this, here's what happens. It wasn't until much later, it wasn't until the 60s and 70s that we really had a theoretical basis for understanding why things happened that way, that understanding what the nuclear forces were really all about.
Here's something else that almost made my head explode yesterday. I read that the Higgs field that we've been talking about gives subatomic particles their mass. Accurate?
That is right.
Why does it take a medium like an energy field to give something mass? Why doesn't it intrinsically have mass?
Yeah, that's another great question, which I wish more people asked, because my physicist friends love to explain the importance of the Higgs boson by saying it's what gives particles mass. And what everyone should say is, why do you need something to give particles mass? Why can't they just have mass? And indeed, the Higgs boson itself just has mass. It doesn't get mass from itself. It's just there. The reason why we never talk about that is because it's a very long, complicated, and difficult to understand story, the short version of which is in the 1960s, Steven Weinberg, one of the world's great physicists, he was working to explain these nuclear forces, the weak force in particular. And the reason why the weak force is weird to us is because it treats left-handed particles differently from right-handed particles. By left-handed and right-handed, we basically mean, roughly speaking, spinning clockwise or spinning counterclockwise.
Okay.
And we live in a world where there's a lot of symmetry, you know, where up, down, left, right, there's no fundamental difference between these directions. If you were out in space, there'd be no preferred direction of space. It would make sense to think there's no preferred way to spin in the universe either. You would be wrong. The weak nuclear force knows the difference between spinning clockwise and spinning counterclockwise.
Now, the Earth spins counterclwise.
That's right, but the Earth is
except
a big,
on the Daily
shy human. I know. I saw Neil deGrasse Tyson make fun of Jon Stewart.
So is that the preferred direction?
Counterclockwise?
Nope. No?
It's just an accident because we are so far away from the subatomic realm where all these things matter that you don't notice. And indeed, this difference between left and right is sort of broken. It's hidden from us, the fact that there's a difference in nature between spinning right and left. And you need that to happen because a massive particle, it turns out because there's math and I won't go into it. The point is a massive particle needs to be able to spin either clockwise or counterclockwise. A massless particle, one that is zipping along at the speed of light, according to Einstein, if you're massless, you must be moving at the speed of light. There you can just stick to always spinning clockwise or counterclockwise. But a massive one needs to be able to do either one. And it's basically because you can catch up to it. So Weinberg showed that the only way you could both have your cake, the weak interactions telling the difference between left and right, and eat it too, have a particle with mass, is if you had this Higgs boson filling empty space.
Now, you have said that this energy field gives rise to the particle, correct? So the field creates the particle that makes up the field? That's
well,
like
the particle
saying,
doesn't...
but isn't that like saying that water gives rise to H2O?
Yeah, and that and you shouldn't say that. So that the field is what the world is made of. And this is one of the great discoveries of 20th century physics that we never tell people. And I think it's, you know, it's something that we really should talk a lot more about. The world is not made of particles. We talk about particles, but the world is really made of fields. And there's a complicated relationship between them, right? When you look at light coming at you from a light bulb, that's a wave in the electromagnetic field. Light is an electromagnetic wave, just like the radio waves are electromagnetic waves. But if you look at it carefully enough, if you look at it with a really strong, really sensitive camera, you resolve that light into individual particles, packets of energy called photons. Mm-hmm. And it's that looking carefully that turns a field into a particle. It's not that the field is made of the particles. It's that the field is made of the field. The field is the field, and that's the important thing in nature. But when you look at it carefully enough, quantum mechanics says you see it in individual energy packets called particles.
So this energy field. What is an energy field? I mean, are we in the middle of it right now?
We are.
I'm waving my hands in the
that's
energy
right.
field.
So I see him. He's waving his hands.
That's
yes.
Right. And I feel nothing.
That's
so
right.
What is an energy field?
Well, that's the amazing thing is that the Higgs field is there in empty space and we don't notice it. It doesn't affect, you know, it doesn't have a rest frame. We don't sort of get pushed back against it. It's not like moving your hand through the air and you can feel whether the air is moving with respect to you or not. The Higgs field, we say, obeys relativity. There's no preferred speed with mm-hmm. respect to the Higgs field. But and it's hard to say what it is because the answer is, well, it's this field. It's in empty space. That's what it is. It's a quantity that takes on a value everywhere in
and
the universe.
And we always talk about generating energy. So what is generating this energy field?
Well, it's – you know, we say energy field. That's a little bit of a casual thing just to give people a sort of visual impression that at every point in the universe, this field is out there. Mm-hmm. But it's actually in its lowest energy state. It has the least energy it is allowed to have, the Higgs field. If you poke at it, if you, you know, prod it and get it vibrating – then it starts vibrating and that increases the energy and you see that as Higgs boson particles. That's what they're doing in Geneva when they found this particle.
And which we will talk about. Now, one of your colleagues explained all of this that we've been talking about in 10 seconds. I'd like to play his explanation
all right.
for you and let me just get your impression of it.
Now, the Force is what gives the Jedi his power. It's an energy field created by all living things. It surrounds us and penetrates us. It binds the galaxy together.
There you go. Now,
it's very much like that, except it's not generated by living things, and you can't use it to choke people.
So would you call this energy field a force?
I would not do
okay.
that. Yeah, and there's not a dark side of the Higgs field, although there are dark matter and dark energy, but as far as we know, they're not associated with evil intentions in any way.
Dr. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist with the California Institute of Technology and the author of The Particle at the End of the Universe. We're going to continue talking about this Higgs boson particle. It's the scientists' search for it, the fact that they discovered it, how they discovered it, and what it all means to us when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC Kenan Flagler Business School. The newly redesigned Executive MBA evening and weekend programs can provide a balanced business education for today's professionals. EMBA.UNC.edu. And Opera Carolina performing Bizet's The Pearl Fishers Saturday and the 18th and 21st at the Belk Theater. For more information, 704-372-1000 or operacarolina.org. With just under a year, a superintendent of Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, Dr. Heath Morrison has presented his first budget. The schools, like much of the rest of the country, are still in recovery from the recession, but the district needs haven't changed, and he wants a lot more money. We'll talk about that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama's 2014 budget includes a plan to slow the growth of Social Security and other federal benefits. Details of the plan and prospects for compromise with Congress.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. Here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Dr. Sean Carroll, the author of The Particle at the End of the Universe, How the Hunt for the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of a New World. We're going to talk about what all this means, and he's doing a great job explaining it in English, as I was promised he would. He's here under the auspices of UNC Charlotte, speaks tonight at 7 o'clock. That is open to the public, and you can get information on our website. Before the Higgs boson particle was discovered, I suppose scientists believed it was there, which is why they went searching for it. Why did they believe that it was there?
Well, they knew that the other particles that we had discovered had all the properties they would have if there was something like the Higgs boson, right? The weak nuclear force was short range. The electrons and quarks that make up your body have mass, just like the theory predicts. And without the Higgs boson field, they couldn't explain those features of reality. So it was either there's going to be the Higgs boson there or something even more interesting and exciting. So something had to be there because we knew that its effects were being felt.
Mm-hmm. They spent $9 billion to build this super collider in Switzerland. That's a lot of money. And although it didn't come from one country, it came from several countries. That's a lot of money. Why was it that important to prove the existence of this particle that we would spend $9 billion?
Yeah, and they is the right word here. The United States was very much a minor partner. We had our own idea for a superconducting supercollider that we canceled back in 1993.
Why did we do that?
Because it cost $9 billion, because it cost a lot of money and we were cheapskates. And the Europeans went forward, and we said,
"Is that why
no,
they're broke today?"
To us. they decided this is something worth doing, and we decided it was not.
Okay.
And why is it worth doing? It's a good question. It sounds like an enormous amount of money, and it is. There's no question that that's a lot of money. It's spread over many, many years. Many, many different countries are contributing, and it has revealed to us a fundamental piece of nature's puzzle that we could not get at in any other way. We're not doing it because we're going to make a Higgs boson laser gun or cure cancer using Higgs bosons. It's purely because we are curious human beings wanting to understand the universe in which we live.
And now that they've used this supercollider to find this particle, what else can they use the supercollider for that they spent $9 billion on?
Yeah, it's just at the beginning of its operations. We're hoping that the Large Hadron Collider, as it's called, outside Geneva, goes on for another 20, 30, 40, 50 years looking for new particles. We don't think that we're anywhere near done. We know that on the one hand, we have this thing called the Standard Model of Particle Physics. It explains everything that you've ever seen with your eyeballs in your life. You know, all the matter around you, you and the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, and the Stars. But it doesn't explain everything in the universe. We know there is something called dark matter, some other particle that is not in the Standard Model. We know that the energies at which the Large Hadron Collider are colliding particles are the right energies to look for new particles. We have theories. We have models that are interesting in various ways, and there's hundreds of them, literally, and they all predict something slightly different to come out at the LHC. Mm-hmm. So we don't know what we will find next, but there's many, many fascinating possibilities.
Prior to your success, to the scientist's success at discovering this particle, there was some worry on the part of uneducated people, and maybe even in the scientific community, that doing this would cause some catastrophic event to occur because we were going to tamper with the foundations of the universe. Did you or any of your colleagues ever share that thought?
I don't think that feeling. I don't think there were any sensible people who actually thought that it was likely. But, you know, we are very, very careful. And there were many very careful studies done. Lots of equations were bandied about, making sure that we could be clear that we were safe. You know, it was very different, you know, back in the 40s when we were having the Manhattan Project, when they were building an atomic pile in downtown Chicago with almost no safety precautions at all. But these days, you know, we thought about it a lot. And what you realize is that there's nothing this particle accelerator would do that nature itself doesn't do all the time at much higher energies. There are cosmic rays in outer space smashing together at much higher energies than anything we can do here on Earth. So there's no reason to think that we're doing something different that would cause the world to be in any jeopardy at all.
Now, because this Higgs boson particle is called the Higgs boson, that would indicate to me that there are other non-Higgs bosons out there. So what is a boson?
Well, it turns out – this is a great question. It turns out there are two kinds of fields or two kinds of particles, if you like. There are ones that take up space, you know, ones that are sort of they want to have their own little domain and no one else can sit there. And that are – those are the particles that make up matter, like atoms, right? The electrons that make up a table – take up space. That's why the table doesn't just collapse. It's like you're making little Lego blocks and each Lego block takes up a region of space. A boson particle is one where the bosons are sociable. They actually like to pile on top of each other. So the photons that make up the electromagnetic field, those are bosons. They can pile on top of each other. And that's why you can see a macroscopic light bulb, you know, because there's a million photons coming at your eye and they all combine to make one big, very noticeable electromagnetic field.
My head is officially exploding. Because the whole idea of light, and I know that light is particles and that they're waves, and that's why we can see, because of the illumination provided by the light. We don't feel it. It fascinates me that we don't. We have radio and television waves going through our bodies all the time to no detrimental effect that we know of, and we don't feel them.
That's right.
It's unfathomable.
And it's not even to mention all the neutrinos going through your body, all the dark matter particles going through your body. And we understand
are
that
they going
very,
through or,
well.
Or do they hit one side and something else is emitted on the other side?
They just go right through. Typically, they go right through. And this is something that we understand quite well, because when you introduce a new particle into your theory, what you should tell me is what its mass is and how it interacts with the other particles. And these particles we're talking about, a very long wavelength electromagnetic wave or neutrino or dark matter particle, they just don't interact very strongly. So there's just no rule that says that your body should get in the way of all these elementary particles moving through it. And we can actually predict very, very, very precisely how frequently a neutrino is interacting with something inside your body. Don't worry. It's not dangerous.
Why is this called, or sometimes called, the God particle?
Well, it was a marketing decision on the part of Leon Lederman, a fantastically talented experimental physicist and Nobel Prize winner. Back when the United States was still thinking about building its own super collider, Lederman wanted to impress people with how important the search for the Higgs boson is. So he called it the God particle because it's a particle and God is important, and so for this important particle, we should call it the God particle. It's really nothing deeper than that at all.
So it's not the center of the universe.
No, it's crucially important to the standard model of particle physics, but you know, as I like to say, I think that they're all God's little particles equally. There's nothing special about the Higgs boson that makes it more central to a deeper understanding. It's just one of the ingredients in this model of physics that we have.
Scientists announced, I believe it was July 4th, 2012, that they had been successful in Switzerland in colliding particles that resulted in the discovery of the fact that this thing does exist, this Higgs boson particle exists. But when they made that announcement, they were calling it Higgs-like. They were kind of hedging their bets a bit. Some time has passed since that first announcement. Are they now certain that they have found this, or are they still referring to this as something that could be, looks like it is, not quite sure yet?
Well, they're never certain. If you want to get into the philosophy of science a little bit, scientists are naturally cautious, and they sort of get more and more confident that a certain explanation is on the right track. And at some point, it becomes tedious to keep pretending that it might be wrong, and so you sort of just start saying that it's right. But you never are 100% mathematically certain in science, in empirical studies, like you are in logic or mathematics. So, you know, to be frank, back in July of 2012, it was pretty clear to most of us that this was the Higgs boson. The real question was, is it the only Higgs boson? Is it exactly like Higgs and his colleagues predicted, or is it a little bit different? And subsequently, they've collected a lot more data. They've analyzed it, and it really looks exactly like what was predicted back then in the 1960s.
You just said something that I think we need to explore a little bit, not a lot, but just a little bit, that scientists are naturally cautious. People have this impression of mad scientists, which of course is Hollywood-based because of Dr. Frankenstein and all those movies in the 50s and 40s and 30s and 60s, I guess. But also because we don't trust science, at least in this country. We just deny it. If we don't believe it, it can't be true. But you guys don't take these pronouncements or announcements lightly. Why do you think we don't trust you, and why do you think – why don't we trust you?
Well, scientists are human beings themselves, and every human being has a whole bunch of cognitive biases. There's certain things they want to be true, certain things they don't want to be true. When I talk about dark matter and dark energy, I don't want there to be dark matter and dark energy. The data force me to believe in these things. But there are other people out there who I meet who just refuse to believe in them because they don't like the idea, and that's a very non-scientific way of thinking.
And is that also because we simply don't get enough science education in this country? So it's difficult to understand these things because we don't even have the fundamentals under our belt.
It's partly that we don't get enough science education, and it's even more that it's not the right kind of science education. We're given science education of the form, here is the truth, here's a list of facts that you need to memorize for the test. But science is not a list of results. Science is a methodology. It's a way of getting results. And it's a very, very conservative and skeptical methodology. Science says, I'm going to list every possible thing that could be true, and then I'm going to go look at the universe and see which ideas fit better. Mm-hmm. And every time I get a piece of data, certain theories are going to become a little bit more likely, other ones are going to become a little bit less likely, and it's never 0% or 100%.
I wasn't kidding at the beginning of the program about my high school physics teacher. He would be appalled that we're having this conversation. but obviously you have always had a natural talent for this. You gravitated toward this field. This is a very complex field, and you're doing a great job of making this understandable to somebody who knows absolutely nothing. And it must be tedious for you after a point to have to do this because you're dumbing it down for me and for those of us who listen. I'm sure if you started talking scientifically, we wouldn't understand a word you said. What can we do at the grade school, middle school, high school level to make this field more approachable so that we do catch up with the rest of the world in terms of kids going into science?
Well, I think we need to capture that imagination. I think that kids are natural scientists. Kids are curious about the world. They're putting their fingers into places because they wonder what will happen, right?
What happens to that curiosity?
And, well, we beat it out of them, you know, explicitly and implicitly. What is the grade you're going to get on this test or something like that? You know, follow the rules. When I took calculus as a high school student, the very first thing my teacher said is there are many different ways to answer a problem. You better answer it my way, or I'm not going to give you a good grade, which is exactly the opposite of the scientific method, you know, the scientific way of thinking about things. There are many different ways to answer a problem. Good. Let's try to answer them all the different possible ways. We need to encourage
that. But how do you give
spirit.
A grade for that? Because how do you know if it's right or wrong?
Well, it's more work to give a grade for work that is more exploratory, creative, experimental. The point is, the thing we should be giving the grade for is the process, not the outcome. Teach kids that science is not a set of dry, desiccated facts. It's a way of discovering mind-blowingly fascinating features of our world.
Dr. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist and the author of The Particle at the End of the Universe, How the Hunt for the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of a New World. Now that scientists have discovered this particle, what does it all mean?
Well, it means that there is a realm of reality that we understand, and it's not all of reality. Like I said, dark matter, the Big Bang, black holes, we're not sure about these things. There's plenty that physics doesn't yet understand. But we can draw a circle around a certain part of reality. And we understand that, as far as we can tell, spot on. You know, there's really no empty places in this part of our understanding, and that part it includes everything you've ever seen, everything you've ever touched or heard, all the particles of which you are made, all the particles of which the Earth is made. And that's pretty impressive. This has been a 2,500-year project since the ancient Greeks first introduced the idea of atoms.
Mm-hmm. How did they do that? How did they know that?
Well, they didn't know it. They were hypothesizing, we would currently say, and they didn't know sort of –
Why would they even think that?
Well, they were looking at the world. They were inspired by what we would now call the data, right? They were trying to understand how is it – I mean, they were philosophers. They were not scientists. They were sort of thinking about what does it mean to say that an object moves through space? Is it space itself that is moving? Is movement real or is it just apparent? And there were different theories out there at the time. It wasn't as if every ancient Greek believed in atoms. Mm-hmm. But there were a few who said, well, maybe – there's the void, as they called space, and then there are little particles, little pieces, little constituents, little Lego blocks that fit together in different patterns to make all the wonderful variety of the stuff around us. And they noticed that that theory kind of worked pretty well. And then it fell out of favor and came back in the 19th century.
So you have said that the discovery of this Higgs boson particle is the final piece in the puzzle of ordinary matter, and that now a doorway is opening into the extraordinarily, the mind-boggling work of dark matter and beyond. And you also say that we have finished up on the easy stuff and now the hard work begins. That's the dark matter and the dark energy?
Yeah, in part, you know, there's lots of hard parts. There's one easy part and there's lots of hard parts. What we have figured out is the basic rules underlying the behavior of the immediately accessible world, the world you see when you open your eyes. So obviously there's many parts of that world we don't understand. We don't understand biology, right? We don't understand economics for that matter. Once you get beyond more than five or six particles in a system, it becomes very, very difficult mm-hmm. to understand. But the basic moving parts of everything you see in your everyday life, we now know the rules that they obey.
But it took us 2,500 years to get to this point.
And the universe is 13.8 billion years old. We should be very, very proud that it only took.
So how long will it take to figure out dark energy and dark matter, do you think?
Well, I don't know.
Will it move exponentially from here?
You know, it's always hard to make predictions, especially about the future, as the famous scientist Yogi Berra once said. And we don't know. We don't – unlike the Higgs boson, which we kind of really did have a very strong feeling should be there – what the dark matter is and what the dark energy is mm-hmm. are things that we don't have simple leading candidates for. We have many, many different models for what could be going on. So it's more of a fishing expedition. We know that there is stuff going on. We need more empirical information. We need more experiments to give us clues. Otherwise, theorists like me can come up with all sorts of crazy ideas, but we can't sort the useful ones from the useless ones.
Zani in Huntersville, we only have 30 seconds, says about neutrinos. Billions of neutrinos are passing through everything, including my body, at the speed of light without interacting with matter. What would be different if there were no neutrinos?
Well, the sun wouldn't shine if there were no neutrinos. That's kind of important. Neutrinos are very often unimportant, but in those special cases where one kind of nucleus turns into another kind, where a neutron turns into a proton or vice versa, the neutrinos are absolutely crucial.
Dr. Sean Carroll, our guest, his book is called The Particle at the End of the Universe. We're going to talk more about this Higgs boson particle and how they found it out, how they discovered it, what the process was in that super collider. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Henderson Properties, providing real estate sales and property management throughout the Charlotte region for 20 years. HendersonProperties.com. And UNC Charlotte, Department of Theater, presenting Romeo and Juliet Friday through the 21st at Robinson Hall for the Performing Arts. Tickets and information at theater.uncc.edu. President Obama's 2014 budget includes a plan to slow the growth of Social Security and other federal benefits. Join Diane Rehm and her guest to talk about the details of the proposal and prospects for compromise with Congress. If you are brave and understand or don't understand physics, you can join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Ah! Molly Malibu was
dark forest green,
a purple four-door.
He was a burgundy maroon, and the insides matched. And my car is making great radio.
Fresh air.
Morning edition.
Car talk.
Wait, don't tell me.
Weekend edition.
A prairie home companion. And that's awesome.
Discover how easy it is to support your favorite WFAE shows. Get details on the Car Talk vehicle donation program at WFAE.org. And thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Dr. Sean Carroll, theoretical physicist with the California Institute of Technology, the author of The Particle at the End of the Universe, How the Hunt for the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of a New World. Previously, he wrote a book that someday I'd like to talk about, which is From Eternity to Here. Frank Sinatra will sue you for that. The Quest for the Ultimate Theory of Time.
Yep, that's a good one too.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Talk about the process that these scientists used in finally discovering the Higgs boson. I know this big thing, this super collider, is 17 miles in circumference. It's 300 feet beneath the Earth. It passes through France and Switzerland, so it's enormous. And you wouldn't know that it was there if you were walking.
It's all underground, yeah.
But they're speeding these particles through this thing in a big circle so that they will collide with each other. How do they do that?
That's right. So you have protons. Mm-hmm. You take a hydrogen atom and you strip off its electrons and you're left with protons. These are good because they're relatively heavy particles and they have this electrical charge, which gives us a handle. Because the proton is charged, we can push it around with electric fields and magnetic fields. And that's what lets us accelerate it to enormous energies and then move it around the ring and smash them together.
And it needs to be a circle and it needs to be 17 miles because you need distance to pick up velocity. Is that why?
Basically, it's actually you don't need distance to pick up the velocity. You need distance to steer it. There's 100 trillion protons zooming around the Large Hadron Collider any time, and they have the energy of a freight train moving at 100 miles an hour. And you're trying to – together. And so you're trying to pull them in a circle using magnetic fields. So imagine, you know, taking a magnet and trying to move a freight train with it.
Why a circle? Why can't it be a straight line?
Because you recycle. Because you use the same protons again and again. It costs energy to get them to that speed.
And why does this thing have to be – how did they arrive at 17 miles?
It was the size of the tunnel they already had built for a previous particle accelerator.
Okay. And why is it 300?
You ask the governments, how much money are you willing to give us, and then you build a tunnel that big.
And it's 300 feet underground because it can't get in the way of life. Is that why it's not because it's dangerous? It's because if you put it on the surface, you got a 17-mile circle that you got to navigate around. Is that why?
That's right. I mean, you're at the border of Geneva and France, and you would have to tear down a lot of houses to build it on top.
So you're accelerating these particles. Are they all going in one direction?
Nope. There's two beams. Mm-hmm. One is going counterclockwise. The other is going clockwise. And there's a couple points at which they are brought together in collision.
Okay. And when these things collide, what happens?
Well, they create a jillion particles come out. It's a very –
Same
very
particles or different particles?
Different ones.
So it's different matter.
And the reason why is because, remember, when we say particles, we really mean little vibrations in fields. So two fields are vibrating. They come together and with enormously energetic vibrations. And when they come together, those vibrations get transferred into all the other fields that mm-hmm. are out there waiting to vibrate.
Now, I know that they – as you said, they built this thing in a tunnel that was used for another – collider. And when they turned this one on and played with it for a while, they didn't get the result they wanted right away, I take it. So they finally got the result that they were hoping for. What was the difference?
Well, the very first time they turned it on, it ran for 10 days and then it exploded. and it was, you know, it was not like a earth-shattering explosion, but it was an accelerator-breaking explosion. There was a point where one of the magnets just sort of warmed up and then blew apart. And it was just a very, very tiny, almost imperceptible design flaw. Mm-hmm. And, well, that's what you expect. This is the only time that a machine like this has ever been built.
This is the most complex machine ever built, right?
That is correct, yes. This is certainly the most complex single machine ever built by, you know, one set of plans.
What makes it so complex? If you can explain that.
I mean, it really is sort of pushing the boundaries of what is possible technologically and scientifically. Otherwise, we'd build a more complex machine. You're really trying to reach energies that have never been created in individual particles by human beings so that we can bring new particles to life.
Have they been able to duplicate this now that they've done it? They did it in July of 2012. They've done it since?
That's right. There's actually two large experiments at the Large Hadron Collider, both of which look for the same things, and they both see the same signals. Mm-hmm. So back in July, they both saw these hints of the Higgs boson. And since then, they've been collecting data like mad, and it's absolutely confirmed that it's definitely there doing the right thing.
And here's where it gets kind of sticky. I read this yesterday, and it kind of surprised me. They built this collider to find this particle. They found this particle. And it's kind of a win-lose situation because they wanted to find the particle and they found the particle. But it would have been more exciting if they hadn't found the particle. They'd found something else.
That's right. We always – that's the great thing about science is that you make progress by showing that everyone else is wrong. And we love to be shown wrong by our experiments. That means that we have a chance to learn something new. And as triumphant as it was to think that this idea by Peter Higgs and others from 48 years ago shows up in your detector and turns out to be right, it would be even cooler if there was something a little bit different. You know, if the general idea was there but we really were surprised one way or another. And I'm firmly of the belief that we are still very likely to be surprised sooner rather than later now that we have this wondrous new machine collecting all this data that we haven't yet had a chance to look at.
Who gets to use that machine?
Well, it's not like you sign up to use it. Mm-hmm. There are collaborations – experimental collaborations that built the detectors that do the experiments, and they get to look at the data. And each collaboration is over 3,000 people, very international. The United States is involved with the science, even though they were not major partners in building the collider.
Hmm. This machine takes protons, accelerates them to just under the speed of light so that the particles go smashing into each other. Why just under the speed of light?
Because we can't get it just over. You know, the speed of light is the speed limit handed down by Professor Einstein. And it's absolutely impossible to take an ordinary massive particle and accelerate it up to or past the speed of light.
Now, particles, I would assume, are banging into each other all the time. They're banging into each other right now in this room. What's the difference as they bang together in this room versus when they bang together in this super speedy collider?
Just enormously higher energies. So because Einstein taught us that E equals mc squared, mm-hmm. there's a relationship between the energy a particle has and its mass. And that relationship is if the particle is stationary. If the particle's moving, its energy can be enormously larger. And what that means is that you can bring to life new particles that you didn't have before. The Higgs boson is much heavier than a proton, but we made it by smashing protons together, protons with enormously high energy.
These new pieces of matter that we didn't have before, are they pieces of matter that do exist already naturally in the universe, or are we creating some sort of new matter?
Well, the potential for them is always there. The field of which they are vibrations mm-hmm. is always there. But it's not vibrating. The field, the Higgs field is quiescent in empty space. And it takes a lot of energy to set it moving. That's why you need to build something as large as the Large Hadron Collider. Again, this happens in interstellar space all the time. There are cosmic rays colliding at very high energies. But it's so rare, so hard to see. And when you make a Higgs boson, it decays away into other particles in about one zeptosecond. So that's a tiny, tiny fraction of a millionth of a second. And you better have the best possible detecting technology we can build when it happens.
What happens? How do you detect it?
Well, so you make this Higgs boson, it instantly decays. So we will never see a Higgs boson. What we're seeing is the particles it decays into. The bad news is that any one thing that the Higgs boson can decay into, let's say it decays into two photons, for example. Well, there's other ways to make two photons. It's not like the Higgs is unique in that way. So it's not that you're looking for a single kind of event. It's that you're looking for slightly more events of this type than you would have otherwise expected. So in the case of the Higgs, there's many different things it can decay into. And we look for all of them, and we found many of them. So we're pretty sure we're on the right track.
So now that you've done this, and the standard model of matter has been finalized. The final piece of the puzzle is in place. You want to move on to dark energy and and dark matter. Does the discovery of the Higgs boson help you in that quest?
We are very, very hopeful that it does. Since the quest is not over yet, we can't be sure. But that's what the subtitle of my book is alluding to, the leading us to the edge of a new world. Mm-hmm. We live in a world where 4 or 5% of the universe is ordinary matter that we know and love. 20, 25% of it is dark matter, and the rest is dark energy. So there's a lot more other stuff than there is us. We are the olive in the martini of the universe. We are not, you know, the bulk of the stuff. And we're hopeful that the Higgs will interact both with ordinary matter and with dark matter, so that knowing the properties of the Higgs boson will help us look for the dark matter.
Do we know, absolutely, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that there is antimatter or dark matter or whatever you want to call it? Or is it just a theory?
Well, dark matter and antimatter are utterly different things.
Okay. We have
to be very clear about that.
Right.
Antimatter, we know about all – definitely no problem. Nobel Prizes have been given out. We make antimatter all the time. Positrons, which we use in PET scans, are antimatter. Dark matter is something very different. It's not an antiparticle of a known kind of particle. It's something completely new and mysterious. We do know that it's there. I wouldn't say beyond the shadow of a doubt, but beyond – we're very, very, very close to saying beyond the shadow of a doubt. We see the effects of the dark matter.
What are the effects?
It causes gravity. Since most of the matter, most of the stuff in the universe is dark matter, we can look at how the gravitational force of this dark matter pushes and pulls ordinary matter, photons, and so forth.
Do we understand gravity? Do we know what it is?
Yes, we do. Einstein told us what it is. Gravity is the curvature of space-time. We have a very, very effective theory, Einstein's general theory of relativity, that tells us how gravity works in the large, ponderous, macroscopic world.
So what do we think dark matter and dark energy are?
Well, they're also two very different things. Dark energy is, again, some kind of field that fills space, but a field that does have energy, a field that is not sitting in its zero energy state. We don't know if it's just the intrinsic energy of empty space or if there is some dynamical field that is moving around and creating this energy. So we're a little bit up in the air about that.
And we think it's there or we know it's there?
Well, again, we see its effects. Dark energy, the effects of dark energy were only first discovered in 1998.
Oh.
So it's still all new and shiny to us, and we're not at all sure about what its effects are.
Why would this exist? Or is that even a question scientists would want to know the answer to?
Well, you know, it's a kind of question you can't push it too far. You end your chains of explanations eventually. But it turns out that Einstein, again, opened the door to the possibility of dark energy back in 1917 when he realized that his equations allowed you to include the idea that empty space itself has energy. As far as he knew, as far as we knew for most of the 20th century, that wasn't true. And then in 1998, we said, oh my goodness, distant galaxies are accelerating away from us. That's exactly what you'd expect if empty space had a certain amount of non-zero dark energy. And since then, we've confirmed that in many different ways.
One of our listeners asked via email what the world would be like without neutrinos. So let me ask you what the world would be like, or the universe would be like, without the Higgs boson particle.
Well, without the Higgs, the universe would be utterly different. Without this Higgs field filling empty space, particles like electrons would not have mass. That means electrons would move at the speed of light. They'd be massless particles. And if you think about it, electrons are doing all of the work in making you and me. Electrons make chemistry, right? They orbit around atoms, and that helps the atoms get together. And if electrons were massless, they wouldn't make atoms. They wouldn't be captured by a nucleus, and therefore there would be no atoms, and therefore there'd be no chemistry, there'd be no molecules, there'd be no life. There would just be electrons and nuclei zipping around the universe, not creating any interesting complex structures. So we are very, very thankful that the Higgs field fills empty space.
You say in your book that scientists trying to answer questions using quantum physics resulted in the creation of transistors, lasers, superconductors, even light-emitting diodes that are becoming ubiquitous in our world today. We stick them in light sockets now. What will this discovery, do you think, lead to?
Almost nothing at all of that form. it's a very good question because there's two aspects to this question. One is, when we put money, $9 billion, into particle physics like this, we are pushing the very edge of what is technologically possible. And in the process of doing that, we always come back with unanticipated technological advances. If you put a dollar into particle physics, the economy gets more than a dollar back. For example, the World Wide Web was invented at CERN, the home of the particle physicists, because they wanted to transfer data faster and more conveniently. So there will be technological benefits, superconducting technology, computer transmission technology, and so forth. The Higgs boson itself is something that you don't make unless you have a $9 billion particle accelerator in your pocket, which nobody does or will in the foreseeable future. So the Higgs is not, as far as we can tell, going to lead to any new technologies.
So to move forward into the search for dark matter, dark energy, or whatever is next in the theoretical physics world that you really want the answer to, are we going to need bigger, more expensive equipment? Are the days of scientists working alone in a lab of their own creation or at a university over?
Well, there's big science and then there's sort of medium scale science. And most of the science that is actively, enthusiastically being done in the world today is not at $9 billion laboratories. You know, this is a very special, unique kind of thing because if you spent half that money, if you spent $4.5 billion, you wouldn't find half as many Higgs bosons. You would find zero Higgs bosons. You either spend the money or you don't. And people are planning decades down the line for what comes next.
I want to know the answer to two questions, but we're out of time. The one question is, why were you not my high school physics teacher? The second is, since you wrote a book about time, why are we out of time? The Particle at the End of the Universe is the name of Dr. Sean Carroll's book, How the Hunt for the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of a New World. Thank you for the hour.
My pleasure.